Hi, everybody. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. It's true. It's the same activity. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, where we feature articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can check out Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the Great Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. That's right, 1955. That means this summer, July 16th to 19th, at the SeaTac Hilton in Seattle. It will be our 60th anniversary. The one and only Andre Debuse will be there to be our keynote speaker. I'll be doing a two-hour workshop on Sunday for the whole conference, for whoever sticks around, about connecting to your confidence. It's a great place to go to connect to other writers, to connect to agents and editors, people in the publishing industry, connect to other, to learn how to connect to your readers better if you're an indie writer. Oh, it's a great conference. I highly recommend it. There are still spots available, needless to say. So if you want to learn about that conference, go to pnwa.org. That's pnwa.org. I should tell you that, speaking of conferences, I will be teaching at Right on the River next weekend. That's right next week, next weekend in Wenatchee, Washington, right on the river, the beautiful Wenatchee River. And I will be teaching a couple classes, including a all-day seminar, or a three-hour seminar, an author's master class on Sunday of May 17th. Craft and confidence, that's what we'll be doing. So if you are at the conference, look me up, ask me any questions you want, talk, get to know me. I love to talk to people whom I've never met, but I've connected to through writing and shows like this and Author Magazine. So that's next week in Wenatchee, Washington. Ah, but this week, today, I love today because today I get to introduce you all to somebody new. Today is Cinco de Mayo, the 5th of May, but it is also the publication date for Brooke Johnson's debut novel, The Brass Giant, a YA steampunk novel that the whole world's going to get to know about soon, but you all are going to get to meet her first. Aren't you lucky? Yes, you are. I can't wait to do it myself. So let's get her on. Brooke, welcome to the show.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Doing good.
Well, so this is it, Brooke. 5th of May, not just any old day. Your book is available to the reading public. What do you think of that?
It's really exciting. It's something I've been, wanting to happen for a really long time. So I'm glad it's finally here.
Now, you say a really long time. Just how long is that? When did you know that writing meant something to you, that this was a journey, that this was how you wanted to communicate with people?
I was about 12. I started kind of young. There was a poetry contest at my junior high, and I entered, and I ended up winning, and I was like, well, I'm going to be a poet. So that didn't work out.
What do you mean it didn't work out? Did you lose interest in poetry, or what happened?
Well, I wanted to tell stories, and poetry really wasn't. You can tell, you have narrative poetry, but there's something in the novel, and I think that I really just wanted to expand beyond just poetic imagery and rhyming and things like that, and go into just full on storytelling mode, and that's what I did. So.
Were you a big reader when you were at that age also?
At that age, yes, I was. Thanks to my aunt. She introduced me to fantasy fiction, and that's really where I got my big drive to write. So
now
what's
interesting is when I was 11, I became a devout reader of the Hardy Boys. But when I was 12, my grandmother came to visit us, and we went to a little cabin by the lake where we had a mini family vacation. And now this, you may connect to this, that weekend or that week, she came with us and she brought a book with her called The Hobbit. that she was reading, and this was like in 1976, so it was just starting to blossom. And my father came with a game called Dungeons and Dragons. And so while I was learning to read The Hobbit, my father was introducing me to a game called, and my world would never be the same. Does this strike you as
like
familiar?
Sounds like a really good weekend.
Oh, it was. It was indeed. And so what was the fantasy she introduced you to?
It was Harry Potter, actually.
Oh.
And the funny thing about that is this was Christmas, and she bought me two books because she knew I liked to read. But before this point, I mostly read like Goosebumps and like Babysitter's Club and books like that.
Yeah.
And she bought me two books. She bought me Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone and Redwall. I read the back cover copy on both of those, and I read the Harry Potter one, and I thought, a wizard, that's like for little kids. You know, this is me and my 11-year-old maturity. I read this back cover, and I'm like, oh, that doesn't sound like something I'd want to read. So I go to the other book, and I'd read everything else that I had in my house. So it was like, well, it's this or nothing. So I started reading Redwall, and I was like, okay, talking mice, this is just, no, I can't do this right now. Uh-huh. So I went back to Harry Potter, and it's funny because the book, you know, I don't know how familiar you are with Harry Potter, but it opens up. It opens up with, you know, the Dursleys and how normal they are and how like they don't put up with any nonsense or anything like that. And that was like, I was just like, yeah, I agree with these people. And then
with the
you know,
Dursleys.
Yes. Yes, I know it's somewhat embarrassing to admit, but I did. I was a very no nonsense kind of kid, and then I guess it was at the end of the chapter, Dumbledore shows up, and it was like at that moment I was just like completely absorbed into the book, and I don't think I put it down until I was done reading. And it was just like, it opened up this whole new just genre for me. It opened up fantasy and science fiction, and things were never the same after that. So, that was my whole entry into fantasy and science fiction, and then also into writing, because I finished that book and I thought, well, now I want to write something like this. So that's kind of how that happened.
Well, that's awesome. And so you were like 11 to 12 years old, and so it begins. Yeah. But it's a big dream, of course, for a lot of people, because I don't know what your family was like, but most families of writers don't have a writer in them. It's a pretty rare writer that comes from an environment where they know a published working writer. And usually writers are mysterious people in a way. So how did you overcome? Was there any sense of like, how am I going to do that? Could I really do that? Or was that whole question never in your mind?
It was really never of if. It was a matter of when and how. Like I had a really supportive family. They were very, very supportive of me wanting to do writing. They would just, you know, make sure I went to college, got a degree, and I could do whatever I wanted after that. So I that's what I did. Is from that point on, my dad helped me get into like some like writing courses and things like that, like long distance writing courses. My high school offered a few creative writing classes, and then I went on to college, and I got a degree in creative writing as well. So I mean, it was like my goal from day one. I just kind of planned it out and did it, and that was the whole thing. So it was
now. I was going to say, if I could, just quickly, the creative writing departments of colleges can be tricky places for writers who want to write genre fiction, who want to write fantasy or steampunk. And how was that for you? Were they embracing of it, or were they trying to steer you towards the literary stuff?
There was a lot of, I don't really know how to phrase it. I really like my creative writing teachers, so if any of them ever listen to this, you guys are awesome. But there was this kind of, not so much like snubbing their noses at me. It was more kind of not familiar with it. They were all more you know, familiar with the literary scene and the academia and everything. So there was kind of like this gap of knowledge for genre fiction. And I do remember several times one of my professors complaining because I never wrote anything serious, but because everything had witches and things like that. But I think, you know, I think at a certain point they realized that I wasn't going to write anything but that, so they kind of just went with it after that.
Well, good for them.
Go
ahead.
I did have one teacher who was very, very supportive of it. It's my final year, and he was a new teacher, a new younger teacher, and he was very supportive of the fantasy. So I think that was a nice boost to my confidence, having him as a professor. So.
Well, that must have been nice, and how good for you to stick to your guns, because I'll tell you, the worst thing a writer can do is think that he or she needs to write something other than what she is most interested in. It's just impossible.
Yeah.
So I'm so glad you stuck with what you actually wanted to write.
It's funny because I think I had this kind of attitude that, well, I'm just going to do it anyway. I don't care what you say. You know, that kind of, I'm gonna succeed in fantasy and science fiction to spite you.
Oh, excellent.
Like, so, I mean, that's kind of the attitude I had. So I just really didn't listen to anybody who told me I should be writing something else and just kept doing what I was doing. So
that is perhaps your true genius. Perhaps your deepest and most useful and practical genius is the ability to ignore what other people think. You know, but I do mean it, though, because it's important to take criticism, I suppose, and you know, get feedback and all that sort of thing. But a writer has got to be able to just switch off what other people are saying so that you can do what you actually want to do. Because I'll tell you what, it doesn't matter whether you're writing science fiction or steampunk or literature or poetry. There will be someone who will tell you you shouldn't do it. There will be someone.
Oh,
I remember going to. Oh, for sure. I went to the first writing conference, and I was standing around with these sort of big shot writers I'd found my way in to be with. And they said, "What are you writing?" And I said, at that time, I was writing what would be called literary fiction. I said, "Well, I'm writing literary fiction." They said, "Why? Why are you doing that? Why are you wasting your time?" So it doesn't matter what you write. You're going to hear it from somebody.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
definitely.
All right, so The Brass Giant. So this is your first published novel. Is it your first novel you've written? I doubt that.
No, actually not. No, it is
usually
not.
Usually isn't the case. Okay, so tell me about it. How do we get here? How many efforts did you have before The Brass Giant?
One. The Brass Giant was my second novel. But the first novel is one I actually started in college the first novel I finished. There were many books before that I did not finish. But there was one novel that I completed before I started writing The Brass Giant. It was a fantasy novel. It was kind of a Persian-esque style adventure fantasy sort of thing. And it was a fun story, and I was proud of it at the time, but it needed way too much work for me to really do anything with it, because I was still a baby writer and learning a lot, and so it's kind of on the back burner, and I tried rewriting it again recently, and I'm still needing to work on it before it's ready for reading. But
well, so then you moved into steampunk, which takes place, of course. One of the things I actually started writing fantasy fiction when I was a younger man. I moved on to other things, but one of the things I liked about fantasy fiction was I didn't have to do any research if I didn't want to. I could just make stuff up. But steampunk, you do have to place it in a time. Now you can change, you can screw around with that time, but this is taking place in London. In London.
It's not London. It's just a completely fictional city that's off the coast of Wales.
Some people confuse it with London.
But you
didn't have to steep yourself in Victorian British history, or did you?
In a way, I did. It was more of kind of a general history. I didn't really have to get into like the guts of like London history, because I wasn't placing the novel in an actual existing city. So I kind of skipped a bit of research on at least the setting part. So that was a nice break.
But so what drew you to this story? Because I always find it so interesting why one person is interested in something as opposed to something else. It's always sort of unique to who we are. And so what first lit up to you about what would become the Brass Giant? Where did it start?
So it was around this time. I think I had just gotten introduced to steampunk fiction through Scott Westerfeld's Leviathan. That was the first steampunk novel I ever read, and I think it kind of was just kind of sitting in the back of my head. Like, you know, I've always liked machines and clocks and you know that Victorian history, the time period, and I think it just kind of sat in the back of my head. You know, someday I want to write a story in that kind of setting. And then there was just this one night. I don't remember what I was getting really frustrated with my first novel. I was trying to revise it and, you know, looking to hopefully query it in the future. And then I just got this idea. It was just a sentence. It was, a machine is truth. And it was just like this really odd sentence. It was like, huh, okay, so who would think that? And it was from there that Petra came to be, the main character of the Brass Giant. The world, all of the history, everything that happens, like everything that is Chronicer City, came from that one simple sentence. And
wow.
I actually elaborated on it a little bit in the book. There's an epigraph at the beginning before chapter one that it's kind of an elaborated version of that sentence. But that's where it started. Was just that simple sentence.
Wow.
One late night, I couldn't sleep, and there you have it.
Wow. Well, that's so often the way things come to us when we're not paying attention, but they light up. And so, it's a machine is truth. Or a machine is truth. Is that was the sentence?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so, can you remember the difference of how it felt when you started that novel, when you started The Brass Giant, as opposed to how it felt when you started your first novel that you weren't able to bring all the way through? Was there something more electric about the beginning of that, or is it just you were more experienced?
It was like, there was like just this, just like, I had to write it. Like, I just couldn't stop thinking about it. Whereas my first novel, it was kind of like, this is fun. I'm just kind of, it was like more of like a writing exercise almost. And this one, it was like, I suddenly had just like this passion to write something very specific. And I was so worried that I would fail that I did everything in my power to like control the writing process. I mean, I before this point, I wasn't an outliner. I just kind of wrote by the seat of my pants and just kind of let the story take me wherever. So with this one, I was like, okay, that has led me to a lot of failed novels, so I'm going to do this differently. And that's kind of, I mean, that's exactly what I did, is I plotted it out and I did so much research. I know more about Victorian science and Victorian history than I ever thought I would need to. But, so it was it really was just this desire to write this story and put it to paper. I just like nothing else.
So I hope our listeners are hearing that, because I will tell you from my own personal experience, just in my own writing, and plus, of course, all the writers I've talked to, nothing will get a book written better, more than what she just described there, than what Brooke just described, in having to write the book and being just it lighting up in your mind. Because even though you were scared, you didn't want to fail at it, and I'm sure you had your misgivings, there is, I think, a level of effortlessness that comes when you're writing something that you're that compelled, where there's nothing to keep you from the desk other than time and children and whatever else, but not this like this kind of boredom and resistance, because you're dying to get at it as you would anything you're curious about. Does that resonate with you?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I wrote that book.
I think it took me four months to write the first draft, which was the fastest I had ever written anything ever before, because I really was writing at every possible opportunity. But it really was that I wanted to sit down at the computer each day and write out a new scene or a new chapter. It's a very singular experience.
But you see, you know what I love about that, and I hope you do. It's worth, I think, that the author can now set your compass towards that experience. And I hope in your future books you can aim to recreate that, because it doesn't have to be a fluke, you know?
Right.
That's something you can, I hope, find again and again and again.
Mm-hmm. And so it's actually something, you know, with a few other things that I work on and off. I usually wait until the story gets to that point, because there's been many times I've sat down too soon, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I didn't quite have enough to drive me through the story yet, and so it would just kind of peter out. And so now I wait and gather everything that, you know, it just clicks into place one day, and then there you have it. You go with it. And that's,
you're very wise.
That's kind of...
You're very wise.
That's how I choose.
No, it's true. There's a writer named Raoul Dahl who wrote, you know, James and the Giant Peach and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, right? And what he said is, I sniff around an idea for a while before I choose it. Because if I'm going to commit a year of my life to something, which is, I guess, how long he would spend writing his book or two, I want to know for sure. So he said that's what he would do, sniff around it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you're doing. Am I really interested? Is, you know, it's sort of like, you have kids, right?
Yes, I do. I have a daughter.
And how old is she?
She's a year and a half. She's a little one.
Oh, okay. Well, you haven't gotten to this yet. But what happens with kids is they'll ask you for something, usually. And what I've learned is I wait to see how interested they really are before I start putting the wheels in motion so they might get it, just like you would with a story. Like, you don't want to leap in and start writing it. The kid doesn't want to just get the thing, because if they're really interested, they'll keep asking and keep asking and keep asking. And then I say, okay, well, maybe we'll... So it's all the same process.
Right.
All right. So your website's interesting because you have a bio, and how can I describe this? As I mentioned, I was introduced to the game Dungeons and Dragons back when really there was no such thing as role playing games, but it. And I started out right at the beginning, at the base level, and I was obsessed with the game. And reading your little humorous biography of yourself is like a trip through memory lane for me, because there are so many references, whether you intended it or not, to that game. I don't know if you actually played that game or it filtered itself through other games.
Yes, I do. We actually have a gaming group we play currently.
Oh my God.
So
that is so funny. So, and now this is what's interesting to me about Brooke, because when I was playing that in the 80s, that's when I first was introduced to it as a teenage boy. There was no such thing as, with a few exceptions, like my sister, but she was about the only one I knew of girls, because those were my peers, who played the game. It was a boys' thing. But that has obviously changed significantly over the last 10 or 15 years. What do you attribute that? Because I looked at it and said, and I'm going to tell you, when I saw that finally girls and women were starting to play, I thought, I don't know if that's the best part of boyhood that I think that they ought to adopt. I felt sometimes like that game was like some of the worst things that we would do, but maybe that's too hard. I don't know. So what is the appeal of that game to you?
I don't know. Like, I like a lot of the shenanigans that happen, just the group storytelling, group gameplay, you only know what your character wants, and you know what, you kind of can gather the story from the DM and stuff, but then you've got, you know, the other people you're playing with, and they do something completely off the wall, and the story takes a nosedive, and you're off, like, gallivanting through something that no one expected, and it's just that kind of just, like, improvisation, you know, it's one of my favorite parts, just the unexpected and kind of playing through it and figuring your way out of problems and things like that. Just that's got to be my favorite part of it.
And it's fun to figure your way out of problems with other people. that you're not just doing it alone, but it's this sort of group effort to figure your way out of the problems.
Yeah. I just love that interactive kind of, you know, you're kind of leading the story and also playing the story and just changing the story as you go through, and that's my absolute favorite part of it.
Now, for our listeners who aren't familiar, she used a phrase DM, which stands for Dungeon Master, which is the person who creates the story. No, I'm sure many of them know this, but who creates the story. I was always the Dungeon Master. That was my role. But I would think, as someone who's a writer, that you might be inclined to play that role. Do you, or are you only a player?
Yes, I have. I have done a few campaigns as a DM, and it's a lot of work.
Yes, it is.
It is a lot of work. I actually prefer playing to DMing, but I don't know what that says about me, but I do. I much prefer building characters and running through whatever the DM, which is actually usually my husband, throws at us. So.
Oh, it's your husband. Strange dynamic.
Yes.
Does that work out okay?
Yeah,
you married
it does,
your DM.
You know.
Oh, good Lord.
Yep.
All right. So are you hard at work on yet another book? Is this going to be first of a series? Is this a Chronicer?
Yes.
Is that going to be a series?
Yes. Yes. It's the Brass Giant's the first in the series. There's a novella coming out next month that's not the same character. It's like a same world type thing. So it takes place in Chronicler City, but it follows a different character. However, I am working on the sequel to The Brass Giant, which follows all the same characters, the same story, everything. So I'm in the middle of working on that.
Okay.
And I'm anywhere from like 50 to 60% of the way through the draft.
Excellent. Are you outlining again? Are you still outlining?
Yes. Yes, I am outlining.
So you're an outliner.
And yes, I am a converted outliner.
You know, I should say, you know, not every. It's interestingly, this is an informal survey, but I often talk to writers about this. Like, I am not an outliner, for instance, and it's really about 30% of people simply cannot outline at all. About another 20 to 30% must outline, and then there's this middle group that do sort of half outlines. And do you fall pretty? I mean, when you follow your outline, do you follow it, or do you allow yourself to take, you know, improv diversions if something lights up?
I definitely kind of veer off the track at times.
That's a good idea.
I mean, because when I start, I do a very thorough outline, a scene-by-scene outline of what the story was to be. But once I sit down to write, a lot of the times, either things that I originally thought would work won't work, or I get a new idea and want to go with it. And so I'll, you know, kind of veer off, and if I kind of need to figure out how to get back, I have that outline to kind of steer me back on track. And but the funny thing about that is, you know, I said I outlined The Brass Giant, and it was the first book I outlined, supposed to be a standalone novel, one novel and done. And I got about 3/4 of the way through writing the novel. I was about 3/4 of the way through the outline, and I realized that it couldn't wrap everything up as neatly as I had originally thought.
Uh-huh.
And because it had just grown beyond my original idea, just in writing it, everything had just, the scope got bigger, the antagonist's plans were just way too broad for me to actually finish the story in just one book. And so I was like, okay, I need to reevaluate this. And so I kind of took a step back and looked at it and figured out, okay, well, if I don't end the novel, or if I don't end the story in one novel, what next? So I kind of loosely sketched out what I thought could happen in later books, and then figured out how I needed to end the first book. So, I mean, I've definitely broken away from my original outline.
Yeah. And, well, I think it's important because when the imagination kicks in and gives you something exciting and electric. It's, you know, woe betide the writer who doesn't listen up, you know.
Yeah.
Even if it. All right. Well, listen, Brooke, I got time for one more question for you.
Oh, I didn't realize it was already done.
You see how quickly it went? Yeah, I know. Yeah. All right. So listen, here's what I'd like to find out from my writer friends that I meet on this show. Finish this sentence for me. If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me what? What has writing taught you?
Oh, gosh. That the human mind is amazing. That has to be it.
Excellent.
Just that,
including that yours.
It really is. Yes, including mine. I'm very proud of my head.
well, you should be. Brooke, this has been a delight. It's the Brass Giant on sale everywhere today. Yes, this is it.
Yes.
All right. Everybody, buy a copy, read it, and write a glowing review on Amazon. You hear me? That's my command. All right. Well, Brooke, best of luck to you.
All right. Thank you.
You're very welcome. The human mind's amazing. It is. Your mind is amazing. It's capable of answering any question. Did you know that? It can. It's true. Just try it sometime. Well, next week should be fun. I'm going to be talking to another debut novelist, Patricia Park, doing a Korean retelling of what? Of Jane Eyre. That's right. So until then, you know what you got to do. Go find something so exciting, so interesting to you, you just want to get to the desk and write it. That's what you got to do. Until then, adios.